Good morning once again. It's Saturday, July 12th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. This morning, you'll hear the second half of a conversation with Philip Baruth, the first part of which aired last week. Philip is a novelist, a blogger, and a regular commentator for Vermont Public Radio. His commentaries have earned him Vermont Associated Press Awards and a National Public Radio News Director's Award. Philip's blog, The Vermont Daily Briefing, was voted Best Vermont Blog in 2006 by the readers of 7 Days and Best Vermont Blog Political in 2007. The New York Times selected his novel, The Ex-President, as a notable book of 2003. The Washington Post has described Philip as one of the newer new generation of up-and-coming writers. He lives in Burlington, Vermont, and has taught at the University of Vermont since 1993. In addition to fiction, he publishes nonfiction essays and scholarship on 18th-century British literature. His next novel, The Brothers Boswell, due out in the spring of 2009 from Soho Press, is a literary thriller tracing the famous friendship between James Boswell and Samuel Johnson, author of the first modern dictionary. When I interviewed Philip, in addition to discussing his books, we talked about politics and his blog, The Vermont Daily Briefing.
It's clear in your blog that you've supported Barack Obama for some time.
Yeah.
I have friends, mostly women, who felt a strong need to support Hillary because she's a woman, and they feel that it's high time that a woman hold the office of president. I'm just curious what you would have said to them, let's say, back in December before things unfolded.
Yep. I had this argument, in a way, as a sort of indirect discussion publicly with Madeleine Kunin, even though we never addressed one another, you know, face-to-face about it. She makes a very strong case in her book, Pearls, Politics, and Power, that it's time for a woman candidate. Hillary Clinton is far and away the best qualified, and therefore any caveats about her personality or her particular road to the primaries, that is, as Bill Clinton's wife, any of those things are not just secondary, but dwarfed by the rightness of her candidacy. And I can really respect that argument. I love Madeleine Kunin, and I couldn't think any more highly of her than I do. But where I disagree with her is that I do think Hillary Clinton, for me, was a very flawed test case for her idea about women in general and specifically the presidency. Because Hillary Clinton, for me, had taken a route when she got into the Senate that I think she thought was the only way she could become president. Mm-hmm. So she became a very conservative person on military issues, specifically, you know, voting for the Iraq War and making the argument at the time that there were weapons of mass destruction. We needed to go in and topple Saddam Hussein, very much in line with the Bush argument at that moment. When it came to Iran, as the primary season moved forward, she and Joe Lieberman actually together were rattling the saber on Iran and voting to hold the Iranian forces to the fire as a terrorist organization and authorizing, you know, at least in the original language, wanting to authorize force against them. Fortunately, we didn't go down that road because it was amended, but Hillary Clinton was trying to make a case for herself as someone who was very tough on military issues. When Bill Clinton was in the White House, the dynamic was that because he had, in the public mind, evaded the draft, he was forced to be much more conservative militarily than he might otherwise have been. So he attempted to come off very hawkish as a president. And what Madeleine Kunin was arguing was that Hillary Clinton needed to vote for the war in Iraq. She needed to rattle the saber in Iran because she was a woman, so she couldn't afford to appear weak. That having voted for the Iraq war, she then couldn't apologize for it, again, because she was a woman, and she would look weak. That may be true, but that doesn't mean that I want a president who will neither do right nor acknowledge wrong because it will impair their chances at higher office.
Or so, a second term.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, and then the choice for me was Edwards or Obama, and Obama seemed far and away the better candidate.
Mm-hmm. How do you get your news?
I get it from a myriad of sources. I read maybe 5 newspapers online a day, not at all cover to cover, but I pick through 5 newspapers that I go to regularly, probably 10 blogs, and then I, all through the day, I surf around anywhere where attention seems to be landing in that particular day. And in that way, I don't think I'm much different, except in quantity, from most people. I think most people's ways of getting their news are fragmented and varied and dependent on chance. Do people send you a link to this or that? And then occasionally a story gathers steam and everybody knows about it, but usually people are picking their way through the fragments of 1,000 different portals. And
isn't it interesting how much that's changed? You know, I mean, when we were kids, our parents got the news either on TV or the newspaper, maybe both if they had time.
Yeah, and from the same channel every day. My parents always watched.
Well, there were only 3.
Yeah. There was a guy named Lyle Bosley, who was the local newscaster. And so every night it was Lyle Bosley followed by whoever the, you know, granite-jawed national newscaster was at the time. So those two people were the news when I was growing up.
Where were you growing up?
Upstate New York.
I want to try a little game.
All right.
I want to mention a few topics that I've read about in your blog, and just if you could say the first thing that comes to your mind as I say these
All
things.
Right.
Okay, the first one, Anthony Polina.
Sad.
Peter Frain.
Sad. And
I know. I'll give you the chance at the end.
Okay.
Al Franken.
Sad.
Okay. Peter Welch.
Very, very productive.
And May 24th.
May 24th, optimistic.
Okay. So now, if you want to just fill in the blanks, Anthony Polina.
Anthony Polina. The reason I say sad is that Anthony Polina came out for governor 7-8 months ago. And did it in a very forthright way, indicated extreme interest, and then followed that up by raising $100,000. And that was proof positive that he not only had interest, but he had backing large and small to run for the office. And he began to respond to Jim Douglas as a candidate, which was, you know, we were sorely in need of, because Jim Douglas had the forum all to himself at that point. And then, you know, he began to make tentative but seemingly effective overtures to the Democratic Party, because he's running as a progressive third party candidate, and it looked as though it might come together for him, at least in as much as the progressives and the Democrats ever can come together. Mm-hmm. Then as you know a week or two ago, Gay Symington, Speaker of the House, suddenly threw her hat into the ring, and immediately all of the news accounts asked, will Anthony Polina get out? And so sad, I thought, because he was the one who was in, who had made his case. And not to say that Gay Symington shouldn't run, even though a three-way dynamic ensures, I think, that Douglas will get in, but I do think it's sad that after all he's done, Polina would immediately be asked to get out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Peter Frain.
Peter Frain, I say sad, because Peter Frain, at one point when I first moved here, he was the go-to person for any kind of news or gossip about Vermont politics. And he just hung up his hat a few months ago, and it's a big loss for me. I miss his Inside Track column, and I miss his blog, Frameland. So I know he's still around as a person, and I see him every once in a while, but I do think it's sad that we don't have that sort of constant voice, because it was distinctive and sharp and gritty, mm-hmm. and I really liked it.
I know you don't presume to see yourself as inheriting his following,
right.
But would you like to see yourself in that role?
I don't think actually that, you know, and that was interesting, because when he stopped, the question was, who will become the new Peter Frain? And there's a great guy named Shay Totten who's begun a column mm-hmm. in his spot in mm-hmm. 7 days. And not to take anything away from Shay, because he's a wonderful investigative reporter and a good stylist. But when Peter Frain was Peter Frain, it was because there was only one person to go to for that sort of thing. And the internet and blogs have changed that irrevocably. So now there are a number of columnists, there are a whole host of blogs, and everybody's got information out there 24/7. So the idea that a weekly columnist is going to be the single go-to source, it's not going to happen anymore. Those days are mm-hmm. are gone, pretty much.
Okay. So he was just breaking new ground in addition to being as unique as he was.
Yes.
Right. Al Franken.
The reason I say sad there is that I was as excited as one could be about Al Franken announcing for the Senate in Minnesota. And things looked okay for a while. Norm Coleman, his opponent, had been held under 50% in terms of approval, which is usually a sign that someone is vulnerable as an incumbent. The polling over the last couple of weeks, though, has gone starkly against him. So I just posted on this yesterday. The last polling has him down by 7 points. And worse, it has his negatives at 39% and his positives at 33%. Partly that's due to the fact that conservative bloggers and columnists ferreted out that Al Franken owed back taxes in a number of states for a number of ventures. And when you put it all together, it looked like fiscal mismanagement, you know, clumsiness, which is not what you want to project as mm-hmm. as a Senate candidate. So I'm hoping he can recover from that and pull it out. I think it'll help if Barack Obama's the nominee and they campaign together in Minnesota.
And Peter Welch?
Peter Welch, I worked very hard, I like to think, to help him get elected. I didn't want to see Martha Rainville in there because she was basically saying she would vote for Dennis Hastert to be Speaker of the House, and I really wanted a change in Iraq policy, as I mentioned before. So I worked for Peter Welch. I was delighted that he got in with 9 or 10% of the vote. And immediately he began a kind of frenetic burst of activity. If you look at what he's done as a freshman House member, it's astounding. Mm-hmm. He got a position on the Rules Committee, which is a very influential place for a freshman to wind up. So he's part of the group that decides the rules under which all legislation will be considered. So if you control the rules, you control a lot. In this particular case, last week, George Bush finally signed a bill that Welch helped to write, which stopped shipments of oil to the Strategic Reserve. Bush, for no reason that anyone could figure out, had kept buying huge amounts of oil on a daily basis and pumping them into the Strategic Reserve, even though oil prices are at a historic high, and even though it was taking all of that supply off the market. So it was almost as though, it was almost as though Bush were artificially inflating the price of oil at the expense of the American taxpayer. And he refused to stop those shipments. And Peter Welch, not single-handedly, but had a huge part in forcing him to do so.
And then May 24th.
May 24th.
Which is 3 days from now,
right.
But by the time our interview airs, it will have happened.
Yeah, so I will either sound incredibly naive or or prescient at this point. That's the state convention, and that's where delegates to the state convention who are interested in going to Denver to represent Vermont at the national convention will be elected. There are going to be six people elected, three women, three men, and I'm running as hard as I can for one of those spots. So at this point, it's impossible to say anything except that it looks like an almost undoable mountain to climb. So there are 110 people who want to go to Denver and six slots. Among that 110, you have people like Peter Shumlin, the Senate President Pro Tem, and T.J. Donovan, the Chittenden County State's Attorney. So people with large, durable, you know, freestanding political organizations that they can tap into. Mm-hmm. So, you know, small fry like me are going to be really scrapping maybe for one spot between us.
Mm-hmm. Would you be miserable if you had to do straight reporting and leave out bias and humor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really would.
And
I've had, you know, because Vermont has a relatively small group of people who write about these sorts of things, I do get offers every once in a while to write straight journalism for a magazine or for a newspaper, and I always am willing to think about it if I can have a certain amount of latitude, but sometimes what they really want is somebody to just generate a straight profile of someone or something like that, and I'm really not interested in that, because the people that I grew up reading and that I view as, you know, giants in the field of new journalism, people like Joan Didion and Hunter Thompson, Tom Wolfe, are people who managed to do both. So they managed to capture the world in a way that you would have to call news, you would have to call journalism. They give you incredible amounts of information, and yet make no bones about the fact that their attitudes and feelings about that information are non-negotiable, mm-hmm. that they have a feeling that amounts to conviction. So, you know, if you look at Jon Stewart on the
Daily Show,
it's the exact same thing. You know, he's going over the day's events in a way that's highly informative, but you're never, at least my friends, are never at a loss for what he means.
Right.
You know, I think maybe there are people out there who don't get the humor or who don't understand that Stephen Colbert is not a conservative. you know, the Emily Latella types. But you know, I think that they do an incredible public service by making that information really fun and accessible.
You do commentaries on Vermont Public Radio.
Yep.
So what about in those commentaries? Do you have to be more careful than in your blog? Do
yes.
they have certain rules?
Not written rules, but I've been doing that for about 10 years. And at this point, Betty Smith, who's the producer, mm-hmm. one of my, you know, favorite friends in the world, wonderful woman, she and I know each other really well. And she feels that I take her out to a place where she's just barely comfortable green-lighting the piece, and I feel like she just barely keeps me from falling off the edge, and so we make a great partnership. And inside that partnership, I've been able to do some very wacky things. So, you know, one of the pieces that I've always liked is I did a piece about Dick Cheney sleeping under my porch, because he comes to Burlington and they need a secure location and my porch has a padlock on it and it just makes sense for them. So they drop him off and he and I have a conversation and then he gets in his jammies and he goes under the porch. And I remember when I ran that by Betty, the last line of it has something to do with a skunk that usually sleeps under the porch who can't tonight because a larger beast has taken his place. And that was the only place where she balked. You know, she said, that word beast we're going to have to think about. So I eventually rewrote the line so that it included the same idea, but she kept the language within a kind of palpable framework mm-hmm. for her. And I appreciate that because nobody wants their message or their humor or whatever to be eclipsed by a controversy over a word or a mischosen phrase.
Right. Does your blog fulfill your desire to write, and do you also write fiction on a regular basis these days?
Yeah. I have a book coming out in the spring called The Brothers Boswell, which I finished last summer, and it's a historical novel. That book took a long time because I should have known this, but in a historical book, when you say he walked across the floor and his heels, you know, wrapped on the surface, all of a sudden you have to ask yourself, well, what was the floor made out of? What were the heels made out of? Would it have made noise? I assume it would have, but... And so then you spend a day researching footwear in, you know, 1745, and what are people wearing, and what are the materials and the workmanship like? So that took such a long time that when I finished it, I decided to just think for a while about the next book I wanted to write. So haven't written any fiction since then. I've written nonfiction and creative nonfiction, but I'm just about to, this summer, start my next book. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go back and forth between the blog and that and teaching and all my other things.
Do you know about your next book? Do you know enough about it to describe it a little bit? Or
yeah, I mean, I know quite a bit about it. It like the ex-president, it's in the near future, and it has to do with, if you've ever read The Handmaid's Tale mm-hmm. by Margaret Atwood, mm-hmm. it has to do with a similar takeover of the United States by religious interests. And one of the things that they're intent upon doing is rolling back what they consider to be a rampant sort of hedonistic culture. So Hollywood is their scapegoat. And connected to that, they're most interested in getting rid of celebrities who have been promoting what they consider cult religions. So they want to get rid of the people who have been promoting Kabbalah, like Madonna, and they want to get rid of the people who have been promoting Scientology, so Tom Cruise and John Travolta. And so these figures figure in the novel. So the novel opens with the execution of Tom Cruise. That's the first scene. And it's meant to convey to people that this will be the future. It'll be a sort of dark look at popular culture and the things that we're guilty of as people who pay for obsessive coverage of Tom Cruise, Madonna, Britney Spears, etc.
Mm-hmm. So you have legal departments in your future again?
Yeah, I guess.
I want to return to the ex-president for a minute. On the first page of the prologue, Sal shares with the reader her thoughts on two statements that she asserts to be lies. One of them is this, that every story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. She goes on to explain quite beautifully how this is not true for BC. But I want to talk about her opinion in terms of stories in general, not about the plot line of the book. Do you approach your fiction with the attitude that stories do not have a set beginning, middle, and end?
Well, when I talk with my writing students about this, I always put it this way. The beginning is whatever you choose to start with. So the beginning has no authenticity other than the fact that you have begun there. So if you think about it in film terms, if I'm doing a film about you, I can start with this interview, or I can start later with you getting into your car, or start with you getting your coffee in the morning. It doesn't matter. The audience will give the writer the beginning. And then whatever moves inexorably from the beginning, they will credit you is the middle, right? So nobody ever gets upset about the beginning or the middle. The only place where anybody's ever going to kick up a fuss is about the end. Mm-hmm. Because that's the place where you make the artistic statement that this is all there is. So this is the shape. Here's where your judgment is asked to kick in. So one way to think about it is when you leave a movie theater, have you ever heard anybody say, oh, that beginning sucked, you know, or I hated that middle, you know? No, it's only and exclusively about the end, which doesn't mean that people don't have opinions about the other two. It just means it's an entirely different level of scrutiny.
But the ending can ruin a movie for someone, or
exactly.
The beginning is, maybe it's even just temporal, you know, it's like already in the past, so it's the ending that you're judging everything on.
Yeah, so people will say that was an extraordinary beginning, but they'll almost never make a negative comment about the beginning, because they're fine if it takes 30 seconds or a minute or 5 minutes to get going, because you chose the beginning and they'll give you that.
Okay. My last question is for the listeners who are writers.
Yeah.
Can you suggest an exercise or an activity that has helped you when you felt stuck or unable to move forward with a piece of writing?
Yeah, I just was talking with my workshop about this the other day. The Clinton book, as I mentioned, came out of that David Moranis biography in part. And my own maybe obsessive biographical knowledge about Bill Clinton. But if you think about it less as biography and more just as a pre-existing narrative, everybody knows one or more pre-existing narratives very well. So maybe for you, it's that you like, I don't know, Audrey Hepburn. And Audrey Hepburn is somebody that you know a great deal about. You know her movies. You know her personal life. That's one sort, the biographical narrative. Another sort of pre-existing narrative is a film or a play or a comic book that you knew well from reading it as a kid. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare, Hamlet, or something like that. Taking that narrative and setting it to one side and then beginning your own narrative and placing it side by side and then weaving the two stories. The reason I think that generates a lot of activity quickly for writers is that what really bothers the imagination, I think, is when you have a blank screen. and you're expected to create the whole world. So 100% of the responsibility is on you. But if you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to take the story of Elvis, and every American knows the story of Elvis, and you would think you couldn't write another Elvis story that would be interesting in any way, but you can play on that really deep knowledge in a way that will be immediately productive by beginning your own narrative and weaving it with that pre-existing story, so that you begin to get the fun of retelling that story from your own point of view, mm-hmm. even as you're developing your own original story. So I did a story at one point called Nancy and Tanya and the Long Hard Rain, and it was about Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding. And I don't know if you remember that.
I shouldn't laugh. That was really kind of tragic.
It was horrible, but
it was awful.
It was wonderful melodrama where you had Tanya Harding was this, you know, tough-talking single mom who was desperately trying to go to the Olympics, and her boyfriend Jeff Galuli, you know, hired a guy to go in and bash the knee of her, you know, very attractive upper-class rival. I mean, it was just pure American theater. So what I did was I had a story about a husband and a wife who were fighting over whether to have a kid or not. And I loved that dynamic, but I just couldn't figure out where to go with it. And at the time, all this Nancy and Tanya stuff was going on in the background. And so I had the guy in a diner, and he looks up, and there's Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan. And Nancy Kerrigan is sobbing, and Tanya Harding is denying that she has anything to do with it. And then he leaves the diner. But in my imagination, the two stories kept weaving together. And so then I knew suddenly where to go with my story, because I wanted to advance the story of Nancy and Tanya, but in the context of his argument with his wife about having the child. And because part of it was known to me, the Nancy and Tanya story, I felt like I could always go back to that anytime I didn't know where the other story was headed. And
use the energy of that story to feed the...
Yep. Okay. And so eventually they come together, sort of, the two narratives, and they become one. People do wonderful books like this all the time, and film is really great at it.
Right.
So you have, you know, something like, I think it's Tarantino's True Romance, where you have an Elvis figure that comes in and out of the narrative, and it really just serves to advance the story in ways that are surprising and that allow you to think about both simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Probably gives your reader a little bit of a break, too, because they know something about the story as well. Where can people find that story, the Tanya and Nancy story
that
you wrote?
It was in New England Review maybe 10 years ago.
Okay.
So if you... I believe it's online now, actually. You could probably search for it that way. But it's Nancy and Tanya and the Long Hard Rain.
When your book comes out next spring,
mm-hmm.
The Boswell Brothers,
yep.
and that's Soho Press... Will you come back?
Oh, I'd love to.
And we'll talk again and talk what's new on your blog. And all right. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Philip Baruth. Next week, tune in again to hear a conversation with the editor of the literary journal, The Colorado Review, Stephanie Schwind. This might be a good time to say that the views expressed here are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WOMMLP, its management, board, or any of its affiliates. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Hike Bedrosian is up next. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont.